You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, where we are doing something special and different, something that undoubtedly is only of interest to a handful of the extreme nerds out there listening. We are talking about Roman politics. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University. Joining me is Jordan Poss, adjunct professor of history. Is that right, Jordan?
Yeah.
At Greenville Technical College. Did I get that correct?
Yeah.
Excellent. I forgot to write that down and I was pulling that out of my memory. Jordan and I met through the Christian Humanist Podcast Network. So, it's not like we knew each other before this. So I am still learning, about Jordan myself. which would be the place to insert an awkward get to know you question if this were one of those things where you had to do the terrible icebreakers. I always hated those just with a passion.
Yeah.
I thought it would be better just to distribute alcohol at the beginning. Except I guess I'm at a Baptist school. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
Well, what was it? Ogden Nash said, candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. There's our, what is that? Willy Wonka reference, right?
Yeah. He quotes it. That's actually one of Ogden Nash's, that's the entire poem. And the title is, I believe the title is Reflections on Icebreaking.
Oh, well, there you go. I totally had attributed that to Willy Wonka.
Oh, no. Willy Wonka is a very literate man, at least when it comes to light verse.
No, that's fair. That's probably a good enough icebreaker. So we left off last time. We walked through some of the nuts and bolts of the Republic. Today we're going to take a more historical look and see what happens to the Republic and see if there are some big picture ideas that we can draw out of that. So we saw the institutions, we saw the ideas last time. Today we're going to look at some of the key people from the end of the Republic. In some sense, this is what we have to look at because this is what we have sources for. As we mentioned last time, the sources for the early Republic are functionally non-existent. Almost everything we know about Rome comes from the end of the Republic or the early part of the empire. So historians like Livy, writing under Augustus, I think he's the court historian for Augustus. Even Polybius, who is earlier, is still writing at sort of the beginning of the end, during the Third Punic War. Is that right?
Yeah. I think he's actually in on. I can't recall for sure, but he may have even traveled with his kind of just lost the word. What's the opposite of a protege? His
captor.
His sort of captor, Scipio Aemilianus.
Was a hostage in Rome, right?
Right, and he strangely loved it so much he stayed of his own accord for a while.
Right.
I think he may have even traveled on some of the campaigns of the Third Punic War, as insofar as you can say there was any campaigning.
Right, right. Polybius, and that's we're throwing these names of wars and names of people out here. Polybius was a Greek who, for political reasons, was taken hostage and sent to Rome. Got to Rome and saw that, unlike Greece, it was not a bunch of cities constantly at each other's throats. It was rather a stable society where the people seemed to be mostly virtuous. Unfortunately for us, decided to try to explain why Rome was so much better to his Greek friends. So we have this. This great history of Rome, or at least portions of this great history of Rome, that dig into some of the institutions. But even at that, it's still from towards the end of the Roman Republic. So it's not the whole history of Rome. It's just the later parts of it. He's writing, as you said, during the Punic Wars. So Jordan, what are those? What's going on in the Punic Wars, and why might we consider that sort of the beginning of the end of the Republic? Not everyone does, of course, but why is that a good starting point?
I feel like my pet phrase last time was it's worth pointing out, so I'll try to limit how much I use that.
Sure.
All of the stuff we'll talk about today is potentially controversial. There are lots and lots of opinions out there. So I'm going to try to speak in fairly broad terms. But it's worth looking at the Punic Wars as sort of the beginning of the end, because that marks the point at which Rome definitively ceases to be a local power. Up to this point, they have come into conflict with their neighbors. the Latins and the Samnites and the Etruscans and people like that, the various Gallic tribes in northern Italy. They've come into conflict with the Greek colonies of the southern parts of the Italian boot. They control the Italian peninsula, which is amazing considering where they came from. You know, these kind of like sheep herding villages on these hills beside this unimportant river in the middle of nowhere. But for all intents and purposes leading into the Punic Wars, they're still a kind of a regional power. Even the Greeks are able to kind of give them a run for their money when they send Pyrrhus along. It's the defeat of those Greek colonies that brings them in touch with another rising regional power, which is Carthage. Just as a matter of linguistic curiosity for me, one of my friends in college used to say, you know, the Punic Wars were Carthage versus Rome, so who are the Punes? That's from the Latin poeni. To the Romans, right, the Carthaginians were still the Phoenicians, which in Latin is the poeni. So the Punic Wars are this series of three wars, at first between two fairly evenly matched rival regional powers on either side of the Western Mediterranean, the Carthaginians on the southern side and the Romans on the northern Italian side. And skipping over a lot here, after the fairly narrow and negotiated victory of the First Punic War, and then the pretty smashing victory, but very, very hard-earned victory of the Second Punic War, Rome emerges as the power, not just in the Western Mediterranean, but given the sort of absence of any other comparable powers in the Eastern Mediterranean, they are in a good position to become the lords of the Mediterranean world. Of course, it's not going to be an easy road from there on out, and we'll talk about that. They've still got to face the various remnants of Alexander's empire, which are on the way out, but still a force to be reckoned with. But why we can sort of look at this as the beginning of the end is there's a lot of foreshadowing here. We see this as kind of, again, a hinge of Roman history, where the old Romans with their virtues that we talked about, you know, the virtues of the sober-minded farmer warrior, you know, the small-scale farmer with the dignitas, the, you know, working to earn auctoritas, practicing virtus, manliness, gravitas, seriousness, as opposed to levitas, you know, being a liberty gibbet. These are the things that make them successful in the Punic Wars. And this is one of the things that appealed so strongly to Polybius. He looked at these people and saw all that they had gone through, right, with the incredible losses at places like Cannae. And Cannae was just one battle. It was the worst loss that they had against the Carthaginians, but it was by no means the only one. They repeatedly lost, but they kept coming back.
And, yeah, I feel like it's the worst loss they suffer in their entire history up until like 370, right? I mean, it's
something like that. Yeah,
I mean, it's some ridiculous number of casualties.
Right. I mean, it's intense, and it occupies a place. Cannae and Hannibal, particularly, occupy a place in the Roman imagination. If I had to make a really cheap comparison, somewhat equivalent to maybe World War I in the British mind or the Civil War in the American mind. Roman nannies long after the Punic Wars tell misbehaving children that if they don't stop, Hannibal will get them. Like, you know, Hannibal right. is the boogeyman who lives in your closet. But yeah, Cannae is this devastating loss of two entire consular armies, and that's a good example of what we talked about with potential weaknesses in the Republican system. You've got two consuls who don't get along, who have radically different ideas about how to deal with the Carthaginian threat. And it ends up with them each with a command of an entire full-sized army of these Roman citizen soldiers plus allied troops. They have to take turns commanding because they can't get along. They can't agree to share command. And the more go-get-em consul on his day of command decides to go into the attack against Hannibal and loses 70,000 men. It's difficult to know for sure how accurate this is, but Livy records that one of the young cavalrymen who manages to escape Hannibal's trap at Cannae is Scipio, Publius Cornelius Scipio of the Scipiones, one of the older clans in Rome. They are a sub-clan of the larger Cornelius clan. Publius Cornelius Scipio, I think, is a teen at the time of Cannae, so it makes sense that he would be out there getting his military experience. A few years down the road, he, and I think we alluded to this last time, he decides to stand for election to an office for which he is by no means yet qualified in terms of military experience or especially age qualification. But because of his precociousness and because of the respect with which he's held by a number of other people, they kind of make a special exception for him. And this points at one of the major changes that is happening in Roman society that I'd like to underline, which is with the Punic Wars and especially increasing through a lot of the other emergencies we're talking about, you start to see creep in a very un-Roman sense of urgency in dealing right. with threats. The Romans, they created this government to move slowly. And, you know, when I talk about this, I compare it to the American system. And I say, you know, politicians now are always griping about how obstructionist it is and how slow it takes, you know, or how long it takes to get things done and everything's moving so slowly. And I point out that, you know, on the original American model and on the Roman model, that means that it's working, right? You don't want to rush through things. With the Punic Wars, they start rushing. It's right. very subtle at first. You get a guy like Scipio, who's a good guy, or at least seems to be a good guy on most of the accounts we have from him, of him, that is. So they're kind of making an exception for a good guy, but these exceptions are gradually going to snowball. Right. And so I hate to leave the Punic Wars behind because it's one of my favorite things. But,
well, and if I can,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just to nuance that or maybe even push back a little bit. I think one of the difficulties, and I know we're getting into the weeds of the Punic Wars, but they're awesome. One of the difficulties the Romans had is there were times when it was appropriate to rush in and, you know, fight Hannibal, and there were times when it was not appropriate. And kind of the two generals that typify these in during the war are going to be Fabius,
right?
The guy who invents the phrase Fabian tactics, right?
Right.
Not fighting, you know, scorching the earth in front of the enemy army. They're hundreds of miles from their supply base. They're going to starve. Very, very counter to the common wisdom of the ancient world that says you attack. It is right. cowardly not to fight the enemy. But when you're facing Hannibal, you don't fight him head on. Right.
right.
I mean, that's, but then there's also that point where, okay, the Fabian tactics have done their work. Now you need to attack. Well, you don't need Fabius. Now you need Scipio. Now you need someone right. who can come along. The problem is when you're talking about a loosely free people, you know, a Republican state, think about how difficult it would be to tell modern Americans, all right, we're going to delay for a while and then we're going to attack, or we're going to attack and then we're going to delay. That switching right. back and forth between mindsets is functionally impossible for us. It was really difficult for the Romans too.
Right. And you see that even sort as far of
all
back
or nothing.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
It's all or nothing. I mean, there's either we're delaying or we're attacking, and we don't have a switch in us that allows us to go from one to the other.
Right. And that's especially salient. And I mean, this was a problem that even the Greek democracies were aware of, but couldn't really
right.
do anything about. I mean, a democracy wants to see instant success. I mean, nothing, you know, nothing succeeds by like success. Right. And one thing that democracies and later, like in the Roman model, the Republic is Republic or Republican governments are going to love, especially among the voters, is successful generals. I've been interested this election season to see occasional calls for like General Mattis of the Marine Corps to run for president.
Yeah.
That's kind of that same inclination creeping in there.
I mean, we have more of a history of generals.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's been what, since Eisenhower, you know, so 60
yeah.
years.
Most of the presidents of the 20th century have had military experience, but yeah, Eisenhower is the last one we can really compare to someone like a Roman consul in the field.
Right. So Wesley Clark ran in 2004, but I mean, he
right.
didn't. I think he won the primary in Oklahoma, and that's it.
Yeah. So, I think there were calls for like Petraeus a while back before he kind of.
Right, before his scandals, yeah.
yeah. Grant, of course, fits that bill pretty neatly, too. And Washington.
Right.
Totally. The Cincinnatus, right?
Right.
Yeah. One other problem, too, is the values that we talked about last time, Virtus in particular, a Roman man is a hard charger, and Fabius right. was viewed in some respects as kind of un-Roman for not attacking Hannibal head on. And that was something that he constantly had to push back against as consul. So even there, even beyond the politics, culture matters. And it's these cultural, the virtues of the Romans, the things that they actually value, that is dictating how they act politically in the field. A similar, I'm glad you mentioned Fabian tactics. This is tickling my military historian part of my brain. Somewhat similar situation actually arises with the defense of Atlanta during the Civil War.
Right.
Joseph Johnston, who was one of the best, arguably one of the best commanders of the Confederate Army, realizes that his situation is somewhat analogous to that of Fabius against Hannibal. You got this very, very aggressive opponent who may or may not outnumber you, in Sherman's terms, gradually pressing and increasing the pressure. Rather than engaging in costly head-on assaults, Johnston drew him out, tried to overextend his supply lines so cavalry under guys like Nathan Bedford Forrest could attack him in the rear. The problem, though, is that that was not a popular move with Southern voters and people who were making their voices heard in Richmond. That Southern chivalric tradition also emphasized aggression and manly courage. And so what, again, Johnston was doing looked unmanly in some respects. And so he was eventually removed. They put a guy in who would charge against Sherman, and you get these charnel houses outside of Atlanta, and Atlanta ends up falling. It's a very – I've seen those comparisons made, and it's – you know, there's problems there, but they're very, very interesting.
Right. Well, and I think Sherman was maybe a better general than would have fallen for that anyway. But I also tend to think Sherman was the best general in the Civil War. So I've just angered everyone in the South with that, I know. But
we'll have to
maybe we'll do a Civil War generals episode just so we can air all of this.
Yeah, we'll have to have that argument about whether or not it is, in fact, to do everything to win.
Well, yeah, and that is a good parallel, I think. So I tend to think Sherman sort of understood the realities of modern war in a way that no one else did. And I think the same thing can be said of someone like Scipio.
Yeah.
Scipio understood that the war was a matter of winning battles, but it was not just a matter of winning battles.
Right.
Like and ultimately he wins the war, unless we had anything else to say about the content of the war itself. He wins the war by invading North Africa, forcing the Carthaginians to call Hannibal home, sort of panicking the city of Carthage,
right?
Because oh my goodness, the Romans are here. Never mind that the Carthaginian army has been facing Rome for the last 20 years or however long they were in Italy. One Roman soldier sets foot on North African soil, the city of Carthage panics. They pull their general back. He has to leave most of his veterans behind. So the Carthaginian army then disintegrates in Italy.
Right.
That has the double impact of winning the war for Rome ultimately, and of giving them their first major overseas land.
Right.
Right. So their first major over the Mediterranean toehold, turning arguably what was a like you said, a regional republic into now a Mediterranean wide power.
Right.
We can probably go ahead and say a world power at this point.
Yeah.
Now they've projected force all the way across the Mediterranean in a way that they'd never done before.
Right.
Which does affect things back home.
Exactly.
Right. So why don't you talk a little bit about that? How do political institutions start to be stressed by this new situation?
Well, there's a couple of I'm glad we sort of ended on Scipio, because that segues perfectly into the next issue, the Gracchi, who were Scipio's grandsons. Right. Scipio is from the Cornelius clan. He has a daughter, Cornelia, who is viewed by a lot of people, at least even in her own lifetime, as sort of the paragon of Roman matronly virtue. She has two sons of whom she is very proud, Tiberius and Gaius Sempronius Gracchus, collectively referred to as the Gracchi brothers. Excuse me a second. Excuse me. Tiberius is about 9 or 10 years older than Gaius. There's a good bit of age difference between them. But in the generations following the Punic Wars, I'm not sure that they ever actually knew their grandfather. Scipio is tangentially involved in some of his older brother's political mismanagement of a province elsewhere that sort of sends him into voluntary exile toward the end of his life.
Right.
Without getting too far into that. So that you've still got those. I mean, the Punic Wars is a great success, but it doesn't mean that the wars stop. They immediately transition into fighting the Macedonians because they had allied with Hannibal. So this is just ongoing conflict.
Right. They have to hunt down Hannibal, right?
Right.
Like all across.
Yeah.
There's this worldwide manhunt for the great enemy of Rome.
right, who eventually kills himself in, is it Pontus?
Yeah, so he's, right. I mean, he's about as far from Rome as you can get and still be in the civilized world, and they still find him.
Yeah.
And rather than, you know, rather than be captured, he commits suicide.
Right. And I think that, well, without getting off too far in a rabbit trail, I think that kind of, oddly, Hannibal comes off as the underdog in the way we tend to think of.
Yeah.
I think that's partly historians' bias because we know how powerful the Romans are going to be down right. the road. So Americans in particular are like underdogs, and so Hannibal is well remembered where Scipio is not. But they both kind of come to in ignominious ends in certain ways. Scipio, though, and keeping alive that in our memories and the memories of the listeners, the idea of auctoritas, Scipio as the man who beat Hannibal accrues enormous auctoritas for the Cornelii, in particular particularly for the Scipios. Which he hands on to his daughter and from thence to her grandsons. So these are guys who are already destined for great things the moment they're born. Tiberius is the older brother. He starts to do his military experience as a younger man in Spain, which is territory gotten from Carthage. But things have, again, sort of changed now. The military is changing. People are... Where in the early Republic, military service had been a privilege and an honor because of the role you were, you know, you had a stake in it. You had a role that you were playing in defending your home and your city. Because of the far-flung reaches of this growing, almost accidental empire, the military duty is starting to become a burden. And we're also going to see the development down the road of the office of the proconsul, someone who serves his year as consul and then has what is essentially consular imperium over military forces in a province somewhere.
Remember the consuls only got to serve 1 year.
Right.
How do you govern Spain from Italy if you only have a year to do it? So you exactly. have to create another office.
Exactly.
You have to have someone else who can do that.
Right. So this is just a geographic stressor that's already exerting its influence on the Republic. You also get political ones as well. And, there's kind of a chicken and egg relationship between some of these issues. I don't want to come down too hard on any one cause. They all seem to be interrelated. But the Roman character starts to change. A lot of what we know about this period comes from historians. Again, we talked about Polybius, but especially as we go forward to talk about guys like Marius and Sulla, a writer like Sallust, who was a contemporary of Julius Caesar. Sallust spends – he's no friend of the nobility. He's no friend of the patricians. But he spends a lot of time talking about the kind of collapse of the old Roman virtues in the people right. following the Punic Wars. These are basically the problems of success. You had this very – I hate to use the word Spartan since we're talking about the ancient world. You have this very upright, tough, hard people who are inured to hardship because of the life of the soldier farmer. Because they came from nowhere and because they've had to fight for every single thing that they can lay claim to. And that's this experience and the virtues native to them that have given them the opportunity to have the success that they have. But that success is changing them. So the very right. thing that has made them great is also eroding them from underneath. One way in which that is happening is that old ideal of the soldier farmer is becoming untenable. For one thing, Hannibal's rampages up and down Italy created a lot of refugees. People just, you know, Hannibal's coming. I'm not staying put. They flee. Maybe they never even go back to their farms. So you wind up with a large population of sort of unattached people living in Rome itself and a number of other Roman cities. This leaves just open land available that the state picks up. You also have land confiscated from people who decide to buddy up with Hannibal. They make the wrong choice and have their land taken as a result. All of this land has to go somewhere, and the state starts managing the distribution of it. They're trying to keep that soldier farmer thing alive.
Right.
But another big thing that has changed is that with this military success comes an enormous influx of slaves. And again, slaves predominantly at this time are people on the losing side of a war. Not necessarily race-based, not necessarily anything else. I think we talked last time that you could even sell yourself into slavery if you're in debt. Tons and tons of slaves from the mercenary armies of the Carthaginians and then the Macedonians as well, as we get this kind of much more intimate contact with the Greeks.
You also have the influx of potential citizens, I guess is the way to say it. So during the war, Hannibal's one of his big strategies had been to divide the non-Roman peoples of Italy from Rome and say, hey, come over to me. Aren't you sick of Rome oppressing you? Take my side. We'll give you your freedom and we'll wipe out this Roman threat. Most of the peoples didn't do that. You have individuals who did. You have like one or two cities who switch over to Hannibal's side. The vast majority of the Italians or the Latins don't. Well, after the war is over, and Rome wins, these Italian allies make this very interesting claim that, hey, we helped you win this war.
Yeah.
We want to be Roman citizens. So even as sort of Roman virtue is collapsing, as you point out, now you have this large influx of people who say, hey, we want a piece of the Roman dream. We want our little slice of I don't know what the Roman version of Americana is, but you know, whatever that is, we want, you know, two chariots in every garage. And
Roman dream.
It really kind of is. And it's, it's really hard not to draw the American parallels here, right?
Yeah.
As America collapses in moral decay, you still have, you know, hordes of people clamoring to be part of it.
Right.
Same exact thing happening in Rome.
But, right. Yeah. And those allies have a pretty legitimate beef.
They're absolutely right.
Right.
There's no doubt.
Yeah. They want to remind the Romans, like, this is a great victory, but it's not the all Roman show. I mean,
well, and it's even, it's a great victory that we have earned our spot with you. Like, we want to be Roman. Like, we want all of those benefits of citizenship.
Right.
And it's really, really kind of, I mean, I could see how you could be a Roman and be really encouraged by that, but that's not necessarily the Roman response.
Right.
The Roman response is sort of the American response of, we don't want you.
Yeah.
Right. We have our own poor people who need land. We don't need this huge influx of citizens.
Right. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say that. So that with the slaves, with the decay of morals,
right,
moves towards the need for someone like the Gracchi. At least that was their argument.
Right. So there's all these factors in play. And again, I don't like these kind of like monocausal explanations for things. So it's an interrelationship of all of these, and each human individual probably had a kind of different prioritization of what was going on. That could have even changed by the day, just human opinion being what it is. So you've got the land crisis, but you've also got tons and tons of slaves. And the people who can afford large numbers of slaves can also afford to buy up the land from the state. So rather than the old small family farms of old Rome, you're starting to see what are called latifundia, the wide lands, or which is sometimes translated plantation. That conjures up a little bit too much of the antebellum South, but it's the same basic concept. Very large scale farms for a wealthy landowner, rather than these smaller patchwork quilts of family farms scattered across the countryside. So even people who would want to go back to the land might not be able to afford to. Other stressors, like you mentioned, there are people now clamoring for citizenship or extra rights because of the role they played in supporting Rome, you know, and all of these peoples were at one point either very quickly allied or at some point subjugated by the Romans. So the fact that they hung with the Romans says a lot, and they deserve to be rewarded. But exactly how to deal with that is an open question. I mean, the voting is done by tribes and, the centuries. Where are all these people from all these other cities going to be factored into this elaborate system that we've already got? That's going to be something that they work on for upwards of 100 years. I think that's so the land crisis is where it's going to really flare up. You've got people who want to be citizens, but you've already got citizens who want land and they can't get it. This is where the Gracchi come in. You got Tiberius Gracchus serving his term first, and then about 10 years down the road, his brother Gaius. I'll kind of try to treat them together just to save time. They both have interests in fixing the land problem. They both can cash in on their status as the sons of Cornelia, but also the grandsons of Scipio. There's that role of auctoritas again, that basic Roman assumptions shaping the way politics is done. Tiberius comes in, and the office that they just choose to run for is not quaestor, but tribune of the plebes. Right. They see the veto power of the Tribune and the power to propose but not vote on legislation as having untapped potential. Rather than just being obstructionists, they're going to use this office to really get stuff done by doing kind of an end run around the Senate. Without getting into the nitty-gritty of it too much, and I always enjoy explaining this to my students because I talk about, you know, these great Roman political catastrophes, and I say it's all about the issue of agricultural reform, you know.
The farm bill, yeah.
Right, exactly. But you can see, you know, hopefully we can see how much Roman history and Roman citizenship is tied up in these issues. What could otherwise be just boring, you know, C-SPAN 3 material is actually stuff that becomes a life and death issue. Tiberius comes to office as a tribune. He's pushing for land reform. Particularly, he wants to do a couple of things. He wants to limit the amount of state-owned land that anyone can buy to a unit of 500 ugera, which is, I think, something in the neighborhood of 330, 350 acres. So the state has all this land. Each individual buyer can get this much and no more. That way we can kind of leave open for multiple purchasers. We were talking a little bit about our family backgrounds before we started recording. My great-grandmother had a farm. I'm not sure the exact acreage, but it wasn't even that large, and they had to have hired help for it. So 330 acres is substantial. You can get a good start on 330 acres as a small, you know, especially as a Roman army veteran, someone who's used to working hard.
Yeah, for people not used to thinking in terms of acres, theoretically, an acre is the amount of land one person with a horse or an ox and a plow can plow in a day.
Right. Yeah.
So it's about the size of a football field.
Right.
So I think if you have 330 of those, that's more than any one person could do in a year. I mean,
right.
It's not too much land, but it's a lot.
Yeah. You would be very comfortable on a 330 acre farm. You could let some of it lie fallow. Anyway.
Right.
This is met with resistance for a number of reasons. One is that it's been so long since the Second Punic Wars. I mean, by the time the Gracchi are coming to office, it's been 60 years or so, speaking in very broadly round numbers. And so some of this land that belongs to the state and had formerly been private farms is now in its second or third generation of ownership by a new family. And some of that might be confiscated, which doesn't sit well with people for a variety of reasons. And this is not just the one percenters that we're talking about, the guys with the big latifundia. These are smaller scale guys too. So they are very interested in what Tiberius Gracchus is trying to push. Then you also get the people who are the land greedy, large scale slave owning farmers who want to further enrich themselves on these very big farms. They have a vested interest in seeing Tiberius's reforms fail as well. The problem though is that, Tiberius also kind of wants to help extend. He's also interested in reforming some of the citizenship privileges and rights for the allies. So that's an extra factor in here as well. All told, Tiberius, through a variety of kind of shenanigans, he's able to use his power of swaying the people to his advantage. So Tiberius Gracchus is interested in a number of hot button issues. And what gets him in trouble eventually is, through a variety of kind of political shenanigans, he's able to use his popularity, literally with the populace, the people, to oust another tribune who had been opposing him, to not exactly call for a vote of no confidence, but basically try to ram legislation through without the consultation of the Senate, which is kind of the Senate, you know, has a very strange relationship with how legislation gets done in Rome, but it is a key and bedrock part of the Roman political system. Tiberius is trying to ram things through very quickly in order to going around the Senate, like I mentioned with Scipio, sort of in the tradition of his grandfather, using an emergency to move quickly, which is not the Roman way.
Right, so it's not technically illegal,
right?
But it'd be sort of like today, you know, someone ignoring a Supreme Court decision.
Right.
So Congress passes a law, the president signs it, and then the Supreme Court overturns it. Well, theoretically, constitutionally, the president and Congress could say, "Yeah, you don't actually have the explicit constitutional power of judicial review, so we're just going to ignore it."
Right.
You can do that; it's frowned on.
Right.
like heavily frowned upon.
Yeah, in the British phrase, it isn't done, right?
Right.
Tiberius, the final straw really with Tiberius, and these are again hot button issues, and all of this is playing out very vitriolically over the course of his term as tribune. Elections come around, and he decides to stand for a second term consecutively, which also isn't done. He gathers, and again, one thing we didn't really talk about, but I find fascinating, is how personal Roman politics was. You have the patron-client relationship where you have powerful men who have these kind of like less powerful men who just follow them everywhere. So every Roman politician you pass on the street has an entourage with them. What I compare it to with my students is I was in downtown Greenville one time and just happened to walk past Lindsey Graham out for a walk. I almost didn't notice him. My wife actually pointed him out. You would never be able to miss a senator on the street in Rome because he would be accompanied everywhere. Even the less powerful ones, right, would be accompanied everywhere by somebody. Even the tribunes have this going on. So on election day, Tiberius arrives with his followers. His opponents arrive with their followers. And what we have here are the makings of armies, but nobody seems to be conscious of that this time around. Accounts of exactly what happened are kind of unclear, but his opponents said that Tiberius made some sort of motion toward his head as if asking for a crown, which is anathema to the Romans, bringing back the memory of the hated kings. A riot breaks out. They break apart chairs and all sorts of other objects, and Tiberius winds up being beaten to death with something like 300 of his followers. And then the ultimate ignominy, they throw his body into the Tiber. 10 years later, you get something similar repeated with his brother, Gaius. He comes to power, and he's I love reading about Gaius because it actually reminds me of my relationship with my younger brother. Tiberius is the older brother. He's a little bit more soft-spoken, a little bit more controlled. Gaius, the younger brother, is much more outspoken and cares a lot less what people think, and so he's a bit more of a firebrand, which audiences respond to, right? Gaius wins a lot of people over, and he pushes reforms that are even more extreme than those Tiberius was interested in. He calls for citizenship for all of the peoples of Italy, pretty much just a blanket citizenship, as opposed to the more selective process his older brother had talked about 10 years before. He's also wanting to push even more intensive land reforms, things like that. Eventually, this creates more rioting in which 3,000 people are killed. And we aren't exactly sure what happened to Gaius, but he winds up dead, decapitated, and thrown in the Tiber as well. Again, the watershed here is that up to this point, tensions could be strained. There could be really serious rivalries. There could be really deep hatreds between the clans and between particular politicians. We see the deep enmity between two consuls, again, on the battlefield at Cannae. They cannot agree on anything, particularly how to attack Hannibal. That never blossomed into full-blown assassination. With Tiberius, right, something changes, something snaps. And from this point forward, and I was just reading about exactly this period again last night, from this point forward, you just get year after year of more and more murders, more and more assassinations. You actually get gangs of henchmen who are basically street gangs who will go around and rough up whoever needs to be roughed up in order to get done what people think needs to get done.
Right, but not like needs to be in the good way.
Right, exactly.
Right, just people who disagree with them.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, gangs of Batman wandering, right, around and being bad guys. They beat up their political opposition, which, right. Anything to add on the Gracchi? Otherwise we'll move on to,
I think I've said probably more than enough. That's a pretty good spot to segue into what you've got to say about, the next.
Yeah. Issue. So I'm glad you covered that, because that Gracchi stuff is so social that every time I try to read about it, my eyes kind of glaze over a little bit, because it is dealing with, I mean, it is stuff that is central to Rome, but it is still the farm bill. You know,
yeah.
It is sort of like watching a congressional debate on a farm bill. It's not that it's not important. It's critical. I mean, I eat as much as or more than the next person, but, you know, the weeds of policy like that gets a little dull.
Right.
What happens as you sort of read through that time in the Republic is it becomes clear that there are two groups. We can't really call them political parties because that's not what they are. They're not organized. So we think political party, we think Republican or Democrat, with a convention meeting and an apparatus and all of those sorts of things that political parties have these days. That's not what they are. Faction is maybe a better word, but even that implies some kind of organization that these just didn't have.
Right.
Bodies of political ways of doing things is probably the best way to put this. The optimates and the populares. So one group of people, this is a discussion going on over what's the best way to do things in society. What we see, especially under Tiberius Gracchus, is that there are basically two different ways of doing things, two different ways of passing laws in Rome, two different ways of coming to power. You could work through the magistrates and through the Senate. You could, you know, walk through that cursus honorum that we talked about last time, march up the ranks of the magistrates, end your career as a senator, having served as, you know, quaestor and praetor and consul and so on. Or you could go the tribune route and work through the popular assemblies. So the question is basically what's the best way to get things done? Should government, if you want to break this down to its most basic, should we have government by the best people? So that's our optimates side, the Senate and the executive officials, or should we have government by the most people? That's the populares, the assemblies and the common people. So over time, these sides sort of crystallize. It becomes, I say crystallize, even that makes it sound like they're organized, and they're just never organized. We have the group of people who say that we need to do things regularly, slowly, focused on the aristocrats. Those are the optimates, or we need to do things, not necessarily quickly, but popularly, through the popular assemblies, the populares. By the time we get to the first century BC, these two factions are at each other's throats, which technically leads into the Civil War. Sort of a foreshadowing for the Civil War comes, and I should have written down the dates on this, but I didn't, early first century, sort of late second century BC, early first century BC, when we see a clash between two of Rome's sort of greatest generals, Sulla and Marius. I don't know that I'm really competent to go through all of the nuts and bolts of that conflict. Marius was a great social reformer, a great military mind. He opened up the Roman military and made it professional in ways that I don't always completely understand. You talked about how the military had sort of stopped being an honor because it was so far away and the terms of service were so long. It wasn't any longer the case. You heard that Rome was under attack. You picked up your sword and your shield and you marched out, you fought, and then you went home. Now you were fighting overseas, which meant years abroad, years away from your home, years away from your household. Is Marius the one who introduced pay? So regular pay or
they were throwing that around. They were throwing that around as early as the Gracchi. I think.
So you always had some kind of claim on the spoils
right.
of war.
And I think pay and equipment are, I believe, right. begin to be supplied by the state, certainly by Marius, maybe a little bit earlier. But he removes the landowning requirement, opening up the army to anyone. And what that means is right. that you get a lot of unattached men, who don't have that stake in the game that we've talked about before. It also, by the law of unintended consequences, makes the army, and there had always been an element of this, but it makes the army much more dependent on loot. So you right. will occasionally get pressure, not just from Rome and the body politic, for a general to get stuff done, sometimes on too speedy of a schedule to be successful. You will also get pressure from underneath, with the army itself pushing for their generals to attack so that they can loot stuff.
Right. Which means that the army, even though this was not Marius's intent, the result is the army starts to be much more attached to its particular right. general rather than to the Roman state. Now, whether he intended to go this route or not, Marius ends up on the side of the populares, right? Opening up the army to everyone and professionalizing it, giving the equipment, providing equipment by the right. state. He ends up as a pretty solidly entrenched populares. Like Tiberius Gracchus, he also breaks that custom of running for a consul. There's sort of a crisis. I forget exactly what it is, invasion of Germans, I
yeah.
think. So the Germans invade Rome. Marius fights them back as consul, but he doesn't finish the job. So he says, look, this is too important to switch commanders. You know, you don't switch horses midstream, as we were reminded repeatedly in 2004. Vote me in again. Ends up running like six or seven times.
I think he gets five full terms as consul in a row, which is
right. And then more later, right. Like he takes a break. So a clear violation of Roman custom, if not actual Roman law. And again, he is on the side of the populares. He gets a pushback. Sorry.
I was also just going to point out he is also a novus homo, a new man, which makes a lot of sense. His origins make a lot of sense of where he ends up.
Right. So he basically teaches his lieutenants everything he knows, including a young man named Sulla, who takes what he learns from Marius and turns it against him. Sulla, man, there's a lot you could say about Sulla. He's, I think, one of the most interesting figures that we just don't know much about. Clearly a brilliant military mind, clearly a brilliant administrative mind. Not a very nice man. So Sulla turns on Marius, and we have a sort of forerunner of a foreshadowing of the Roman Civil War. Eventually, they come to actual conflict. Battles are fought that I know nothing about, where Roman legions face other Roman legions under the command of these two men. Sulla entrenches himself on the side of the Optimates. He wins. I don't know if he wins because he is inherently a better general or just because he is so much younger than Marius.
Marius dies at some point during this. Okay. So Marius is serving as consul again, and he dies in office. The omens are not good for electing a new consul, so one guy finishes out. And then I think that guy runs again and with another running mate who are both Marians. And they are still trying to kind of hold his deal together after Marius has actually died when Sulla comes back to Rome and starts killing people.
Right. So Sulla, having won this civil war, Marius, like you said, dies, then enters Rome with his legions. It was against the law. And this was not a custom. This was an actual law. It was against the law to enter Rome armed.
Right.
Sulla shows up with a Roman army, that had never been done before. Passes, and you can't see the air quotes, but, you know, passes a bunch of laws intended to shut down the populares and entrench the Optimates for all time. The Sullan reforms, they basically outlaw anyone who had been a Marian, executes a fairly large number of people. He publishes a list of people who are considered enemies of the state. They all get executed. Again, an interesting figure because it seems like many of these people in some sense actually were enemies of the state. So it's not as if it's not as if everything he's doing is absolutely wrong, but then again, some of the people on the list were just political enemies, people who disagreed. Sulla gets himself elected dictator, which was this office that lasted for 6 months, where you have kind of absolute power, and then does something that just throws our historical analysis of him into complete disarray. Having made all of these reforms, he resigns. Which is a fairly surprising move for lots and lots of reasons. You know, who gives up power, right? It suggests that maybe he's not really a tyrant. Maybe he really did believe in these things.
He's the guy getting his hands dirty for a good reason. Good reason.
Yes. By and large, his reforms. I mean, they were reforms in the sense he was setting Rome back a couple of hundred years. So Sulla was in some sense a good conservative. I mean, he was looking at what the Roman Republic had been pre Punic Wars, saying that's what it should be again, and then trying to set that stuff down into law. But he makes a fatal error in his political calculations. Sulla had thought that he was bringing one particular group into power. So he had thought that he was sort of bringing these Optimates into power and then entrenching them there for all time through the use of the law. In reality, everything that he did, he was able to do in the first place only because of his command of the army. What he didn't realize, and what it seems that nobody realizes at this point, is that the new source of power in Rome is the army. For the next 30 years or so, that doesn't matter. From 79 BC, so that's the year Sulla retires, until the mid-40s BC, the armies of Rome are busy in a series of largish wars around the Mediterranean. They're are kind of all abroad. The generals who might have been tempted to use the army in the way that Sulla had were busy leading those wars. These generals were rarely in Rome at the same time, so opportunities for conflict don't arise the way that they might have. But still, that precedent is set. These reforms don't last. Before we talk about what happens to Sulla's reforms and where things go, not really a historical aside, but a sign that things are wrong comes when Rome faces a revolt from within that's not optimates versus populares, but another group of people versus citizens. Jordan, you want to tell us a little bit about these folks?
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Yeah, this is the Spartacus Revolt, which is maybe one of the most famous. I mean, if you get an average person to name someone from Roman history, they'll probably go to Caesar. But if they had to go with, you know, after the first one or two, Caesar, Cleopatra, if they're even aware of her as kind of in the Roman ambit, probably Spartacus is going to be in your top five of popularly known today historical figures. For a variety of reasons, he's got the Kirk Douglas movie, he's got the recent TV shows that we talked a little bit about just last time after the show was over. Spartacus is a sign of the way things have changed for a number of reasons. There have been slave revolts before. This is a endemic danger to slave societies. There was a couple of servile rebellions on Sicily, I believe, at various points. Spartacus, though, is the big one, and it's the one that really, really threatens to do damage to the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. And speaking of kind of popular Roman entertainment, it's interesting to me the way this period has generated so many kind of soap opera-ish sort of retellings over the years, and it makes so much sense because we're now in a stage in which every generation has this new drama unfolding, and so you can see the pieces being set for the next stage of the tragedy. We kind of see that with Sulla, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but one of Sulla's lieutenants is a young 22-year-old guy named Pompey. Crassus is out there in the mix. Marius's nephew by marriage is a young man named Julius Caesar who has to flee Rome. Right. All of these pieces are being set. And at the same time, you've also got old problems continuing to rear their heads. And one of these is that big influx of slaves. Spartacus, contrary to the Kirk Douglas version, Spartacus is not actually born into slavery. He's probably a Thracian warrior, possibly even a Thracian general. We aren't really sure. It's very, very unclear exactly where he comes from, but he's probably one of these slaves captured. Again, details are very sketchy because this is at first a very small incident, like the Sicilian servile rebellion. It starts in the kitchen. They get kitchen knives. They are able to kill some of their guards. They are able to acquire some of their own weapons. They kill some Roman actual army patrols in the area. They take their weapons. And it sort of has this snowball effect where this vast slave population that now populates large swaths of the agricultural land of Italy, there is a large population of people there ready to go over to someone like Spartacus, especially, you know, these people who have been taken captive, people who can remember freedom in their own lifetimes. So Spartacus builds a very sizable slave army over the course of several months. He's able to hide out, kind of make Mount Vesuvius, which is the pre-eruption era, turns Mount Vesuvius into sort of a mountain fastness, is able to hold out there for a while, drawing more and more people to his side. Streamlining a great deal here. They start off sending kind of small forces to try to take him down. These are unsuccessful. He's able, with, again, kind of a core of trained fighters and then gradually just sheer numbers, to either throw back everything sent against them or just annihilate it. Eventually, they're sending full-sized consular armies to bring him down. And the guy who decides to make it his business to really bring Spartacus down is Marcus Licinius Crassus, who, the sole saving grace of this election cycle is that Donald Trump gives me a new person to compare Crassus to. I've been having to go back to Ross Perot, and I always have like two students who even know who Ross Perot is.
Right.
Crassus is the guy who's rich enough to be involved. Crassus is apparently a pretty affable guy. It's a lot of his wealth in shady real estate deals, especially some of that land confiscated during the whole Marius and Sulla thing. He's able to sell at a higher price. Crassus makes it his business to bring Spartacus down, which he does. But one of these other young has actually just come back from a campaign in Spain, and this is Pompey. Pompey is able to swoop in and get, I think five or six thousand of Spartacus's survivors following this big cataclysmic battle that Crassus fights. And as a result, Pompey actually winds up getting a lot of the credit bringing Spartacus down, when really Crassus does most of the heavy lifting. So this is setting up two rivals here. This is it is by no means a minor incident. It causes a lot of fear and consternation, especially because, again, you look out the window of your Roman house, and if you're anybody of means, you're going to have one or two slaves out there, and you start, the gears start turning, right? They work with tools all the time. They have access to the kitchen. They probably have access to your weapons if you've ever served in the army. So this is by no means a minor incident, but it is really setting the stage for a rivalry between two men that is eventually going to pull a third into its orbit and create the kind of dynamic that's going to actually ultimately bring the Republic down.
Yeah, and that leads into the sort of collision of these three men. Really, in some ways, this next 50, 60 years, next century that we're going to be talking about is unfortunate. So if you think of a generation like the American founding, right, where you have all of these great men kind of living at the same time, right? Hamilton and Madison and Washington and Franklin and the Adamses, and I mean, just on and on and on. You have something very similar during this century in the Roman Republic, right? These people who are just phenomenally brilliant, amazingly skilled, and they fight each other. So, you know, imagine if we'd had, Washington versus Jefferson, or you know, the Adamses versus the Madisons, or something like that.
Well, think of Adams versus Jefferson in 1800.
Right. So if we hadn't had that initial them working together, where would we have been? You know, and they just I guess maybe there is a sort of a loose parallel where they start working together and then turn against each other, but it spills into open combat. So where people start, you know, I think we'll talk a little bit about parallels between this time and ours. I think one of the reasons not to be too afraid that we are at sort of the end of our Republic moment is we don't really have these great men running around who are disaffected, right? We don't have these phenomenally brilliant and competent people who are at each other's throats all the time. We have a bunch of, you know, narcissistic infants who are at each other's throats all the time, and that's just not the same thing. Again, that sort of this leads into this collision. So the reforms that Sulla had put in place to solidify the power of the Optimates were mostly undone within a decade of his death, mostly by his own lieutenants, mostly by Pompey and Crassus. So they come back. They put down this slave revolt. They work with another former consul named Lepidus to try to bring these two parties together. The agreement that they strike is that they're going to get rid of the worst of Sulla's laws in exchange for being elected consuls. So Pompey and Crassus get elected to the highest executive office in the land. Pompey is then sent east to fight pirates. He disappears from the political scene for a while. So he's not around when a lot of what we're going to talk about goes down. This leaves some of the populares very unhappy with the compromise. They wanted all of Sulla's laws gotten rid of, and they wanted to go to sort of back to the pre-Sulla stage, where things were opening up for the common people. They gather around them, around this populares faction, a group of disaffected nobles and poor malcontents, under the leadership of a young aristocrat named Catalan. Catalan. I'm not sure what the right way to pronounce that is. I've always heard a Catiline, but then my Latin professor said a Catalan, so I don't know where we go with that.
I think it's actually like Catalinus or something. I mean, the anglicized version can go whatever way.
Right. So originally this is a political movement. In its earliest days, Crassus was on board with this. Julius Caesar was on board with this. Basically, an attempt to finish undoing the work of Sulla. Crassus and Caesar very quickly see that Catiline is kind of a moron, and they drop their support of him. When Catiline finds out that he can't get what he wants politically, he starts planning to follow in the footsteps of Sulla and use an army to get what he wants. But again, he's a moron. News of this leaks out to the consul that Catiline is planning a revolution. The consul is a novus homo, a new man named Cicero. Cicero gives this impassioned speech in the Senate and leads an army against him. I don't know how aware at the time people were that Cicero is you know, the greatest orator that Rome had ever produced, but they certainly found out at this point. You have this great image of I think the idea is Catiline was at the Senate when the speech was given, and senators start to get up and move away from him until the speech is over. Catiline is sitting by himself. Is that historically accurate or not? I don't know, but it's a great sort of movie moment in Roman history.
There's a really great 19th century painting of that moment that I show on my PowerPoint. I always point out that this is later art, but it is a really great dramatization of that moment.
Right. And Cicero, for all of his failings, he handles this fairly well, sort of. So Cicero denounces him in the Senate, leads an army against him. This is sort of the last moment of true unity between the two factions. This threat to the Republic is put down by the populares and the optimates, together. The general good feeling that Cicero rightly brags about for the rest of his life. He never again gives a speech where he doesn't mention that time he overthrew the threat to the Republic. That disappears very quickly. And it is almost certainly the fault of the Senate that it disappears. This conspiracy, this attempt to repeat the work of Sulla is thwarted. Pompey returns after this from fighting in the Eastern Mediterranean. He'd been sent to fight pirates, which we don't tend to think of pirates as something you send the military out against, but pirates were a bigger deal then. They were really more like small rampaging armies. At one point, they'd even captured Julius Caesar and were holding him for ransom. The way I remember it is they held him for ransom, but they set the ransom too low, so he made them raise it.
Yeah.
And then someone finally paid it, so he got released, and then he went back and, like, wiped them all out for daring to take him hostage, even though he'd made friends with him while he was being held hostage or something. I mean, it is kind of a fun story.
And apparently he used to, like, rib them. It's like, you know, when I get out, I'm going to come back and kill you all, ha-ha, and then he did it.
He actually did, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, as we'll see, you don't really want to cross Caesar. Who now enters the story? So Pompey returns from fighting in the east. Crassus had been governor of Spain. He comes back, and Caesar is now the rising star of the populares party. So Caesar is a populares. That becomes very important. These three meet together and sort of discuss the future of Rome. They decide that the three of them together are going to sort of divvy up the political offices. We call this the first triumvirate. It is nothing formal. It's just three guys sort of privately meeting together and coming to an agreement, which, you know, on one level, we just say, hey, that's politics, right? That sort of thing happens all the time. But notice that the private agreement that they come to involves passing out public offices. I think you could make a good argument that at this point, for all intents and purposes, the Republic is dead. You now have three men making a private decision about who will fill what office, especially since everything they agree to do works. So Caesar is elected consul. He is paired with a member of the other political party. Caesar then uses his office to push through a bunch of things that Pompey had wanted done politically. The big issue that they're dealing with is what to do with veterans returning from combat. So as these wars are being won around the Mediterranean, and this is a politics, not a military episode, but at this point, the Roman army is the most powerful and efficient military machine in the world. They've perfected it. The Marian reforms especially go a long ways towards perfecting this army to the point where there's nothing else in the ancient world that can stand up against it. The age of Greek militaries being able to oppose Rome the way they had under Pyrrhus are just over. There's nothing anyone else can throw against the Roman army. So they're incredibly effective. They sort of travel around the Mediterranean, just trouncing people left and right. And then what do you do with these guys when they come back? So again, there's some question of how to handle this. The big plan they come up with is all of that state land that's just kind of hanging out in Italy, well, that needs to be divided up and given to veterans. Well, the Senate does not like this idea. It is seen as a way to empower the common people. It is seen as a trick by the populares to entrench themselves in power. So they keep opposing it, which sort of drives Caesar and Crassus and Pompey more and more and more into the camp of the populares. Caesar, ending up his year as consul, begins having people exiled. The two senators that he sees as his greatest enemies are kicked out of the Senate. Cato, or not kicked out of the Senate, but sent into exile. Cato the Younger and Cicero are both banished. Caesar then leaves. He is appointed governor of Gaul. Once he's out of town, everything that he had put in place collapses. Pompey switches sides and turns against Caesar. So we begin to see the setup for the war, right? The setup for the open civil war, especially when Crassus gets himself killed back east. So sort of the guy who had tied Caesar and Pompey together is removed. He's killed in Syria, as we will see in a couple of episodes. Like America, Rome sort of never knew what to do with the Middle East. They would show up, smash things up, destabilize the region, and then leave, and hope that that was, you know, sort of good enough to buy them a century of peace or so. And it, you know, it usually was. They were, of course, less concerned with the human cost of the Middle East than we tend to be. That did, in a sense, work for Crassus, but he got himself killed in the process. In Rome, things are really starting to destabilize. The optimates and the populares are now fighting in the streets. Two tribunes are sort of the focal point of this. One tribune named Clodius, another tribune named Milo, are leading gangs against each other. Finally, a riot breaks out between the tribunes. Between the gang under the tribune Clodius and the gang under the tribune Milo. Clodius is killed in this rioting. You have a tribune of the plebs who, remember, these are supposed to be sacrosanct, who's killed, murdered in the streets. So you know there are sort of serious problems going on. With Crassus dead, Caesar out of town in Gaul. Gaul is modern France. Pompey decides it's time to make his move. He switches over to the party of the optimates. And starts putting through laws that are aimed at overthrowing Caesar, which is an interesting sort of choice on his part. Caesar, remember, you're supposed to wait this amount of time between holding offices. Caesar had gotten a special exemption for himself, so he was consul in Rome, then got himself appointed governor in Gaul with no time in between. So he got a special exemption to the law put in place for himself. That exemption was written by Pompey. Well, Pompey now says that was illegal. Caesar has broken the law and he needs to be punished. Caesar says, well, wait a second. That, you know, I have a special exemption and I would like another special exemption because as long as I'm serving in office, I can't be charged with a crime. So I want an extension on my office so that no one can charge me with a crime. Caesar's representative addresses the Senate with this proposal, demands that the Senate respect the special provisions that Caesar had received. Yeah, so the Senate refuses to respect these provisions that they granted Caesar, demands that Caesar lay down his command and come to Rome to face charges or else be declared an enemy of the state. When Caesar gets this message, he crosses the Rubicon with his army so quickly that it catches Pompey and the Senate by surprise. They flee the city. The government collapses. And for all intents and purposes, Rome is placed under martial law by Caesar. This is now we're into the weeds of the Roman Revolution. There's no doubt at this point that it's ongoing. We could argue about when it actually starts, but at this point we're definitely into it. Jordan, anything to add about that sort of stretch of, I guess, what, about 40 years, 30 years in there?
Oh man. yeah, there's so much we could talk about, even on the personal level. I mean, you know, again, every point that we could talk about here is somewhat controversial, but I've seen interesting pointers that at some point, even all other political considerations aside, the only thing holding the what's left of the triumvirate together is the fact that Caesar marries his daughter Julia to Pompey.
Right.
I believe, and unusually for this world and particularly political marriages, apparently they actually love each other.
Right.
She
Which
is,
the miniseries makes good bank out of, right? The Rome series.
It's been. I watched that in grad school like 6 years ago. I want to say they do, but I can't recall for sure.
I feel like that's they start with that, and that's kind of the breaking point between Caesar and Pompey.
Right. All other things being equal, the Caesar and Pompey don't really hate each other. It's not like this, you know, kind of duel of deep enemies. They are just on opposite sides of political issues. Caesar, once Pompey is dead, Caesar supposedly weeps over his corpse, because he was his son-in-law.
Which is weird, because Pompey's older.
Right, yeah, Pompey's older than Caesar, and he's, like, old enough to be Julia's grandfather. But they've got this very interesting kind of triangulated relationships that apparently makes it work. Caesar loves his daughter, Pompey loves his wife. With all the other stresses at work politically, that seems to play some kind of role in hanging the whole thing together. Once she is dead, I believe she dies in childbirth, which is a devastating blow to a Roman family, right? Simultaneously robbing someone of a wife and a daughter and the continuation of this family. That's pretty much it between Caesar and Pompey. Caesar, it's worth noting his ability to sway the crowd even from afar. We have Caesar's commentaries, right? The Gallic War, which are written by him, interestingly, in the third person. And he sends those home, if I remember correctly, he sends those home in batches as sort of like his dispatches from what he's actually up to in Gaul. Because he's aware that, you know, he's popular, he's famous among the people. He doesn't want to lose that. He doesn't want to lose that critical mass of the popularity with the mob, who, again, love a very successful general. So he's a very shrewd and canny player who's able to keep himself as a key living part of what's going on in Roman politics, even though he doesn't visit Rome for 10 years. Which is, again, one of the things that makes the Senate afraid of him. He's also got, and again, personality plays a role here. He's got a monumental ego. He has Virtus. He has Auctoritas. He's also got a get as much gloria for himself as he can, and nothing is going to stand in the way of that.
Yeah, which is interesting, because he the way I try to sort of talk to this about to my freshman, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but my feel for Caesar is of kind of the three jobs he has, he's a terrible lawyer. So he goes up time and time and time again against Cicero and the courts, and just Cicero wipes the floor with him. He does not know what he's doing at all. He's an okay general. A terrible lawyer, maybe a military genius, certainly a political genius. Absolutely just read what was going on at Rome, despite having been gone for 10 years, had his finger right on the pulse of what was happening, came back at the right time, did all of the right stuff, including extending mercy to his enemies, to his political opposition, whenever he could. There's a great passage in Sallust where it sort of compares Cato and Caesar. Where Cato the Younger is kind of the exemplar of the best of the optimates. Caesar is the exemplar of the best of the populares. And one of the aspects of Caesar's character is his clementia, his mercy to the fallen. But his political goals. So if you sort of break these down, there seem to have been four of them. What does he do to sort of cement his rule in Rome? He wants to eliminate all opposition to Roman authority within the borders of the state. Rome is to be ascendant. The legitimate government is to be ascendant within the bounds of everything Rome rules. We can't really call it a republic anymore, but it's maybe not quite an empire yet. Second, he wants to establish a government in the city of Rome that will be strong enough to enforce its laws anywhere under Roman control, so that people won't be able to do what he did and defy the orders of Rome. No more Caesars is not the way he says it, but that's basically what he means. So he and that's sort of a third thing. He wants to keep anyone from being able to overturn the legitimate government of the state. So he institutes a thoroughgoing reform of all government offices to try to sort of calibrate the republic now for ruling something that stretches from Spain to the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, Spain to Syria, the English Channel to Egypt, or the English Channel to Northern Africa at least, is all under Roman authority at this point. So how do we fix these offices so that they can now manage this? And then he wants to bind all of those lands into one unified state, right? Again, the idea of some proconsular governor being able to just go off on his own authority and march into Rome for Caesar is that's a bad thing. So how do we keep that from happening? It means he has to establish that authority across the board, right? Yeah, which means wiping out his political enemies first, either by winning them over to his side or by beating them on the battlefield, which he does kind of a mix of those things. He beats on the battlefield Pompey, of course, and then beats on the battlefield Brutus and Cicero, who then come over to his side. He sort of opens up his arms and says, you know, this terrible misunderstanding, but now we can all be one big Roman family again. They come over to him. He forgives them, puts them both in positions of power, with which, at least with Brutus, ends up being a mistake. So you have holdouts, right? Like Cato, who just will never bow his neck to a tyrant, like Caesar, who I think ends up committing suicide, right? And Cicero, who's kind of all over the place. So no prescription lists. People are anyone who will come and ask, gets forgiveness, gets brought back into the state, and gets given a position of authority. Caesar is very, very open. And the other difference from Sulla is Caesar is a popularis. So this is not solidifying the power of the aristocracy. This is not necessarily going back to the old sort of pre-Punic War way of doing things. And in fact, Caesar, it's maybe too far to say that he guts the Republican institutions, but maybe not too far. So he strips the consul's term of service down to what, 8 months, 7 months, something like that. So now instead of a year, you now have these highest elected official in the state who, you know, couldn't do anything in a year. Now they have even less time, which gives him the chance to sort of resign from the consulship and say, hey, I'm not even the consul anymore. You have four consuls in a year. They're the ones with the power, although they don't have any time whatsoever to use that power. And obviously he's picking these people. So they're picking those. He increases the number of people in the Senate to something like 900. Well, a lot of those Roman aristocratic families who maybe would have been qualified for that have been wiped out in the civil wars. So he starts packing them in with people that he knew, including nobles from Gaul. So the story is you have these, you know, savages being brought into the Senate. That's not entirely true. They were mostly Romans who had been living in Gaul, but still in the popular or in the mind of the Optimates, you know, this is just wrecking the Senate by bringing in these barbarians. He changes the way the popular assemblies work, so that all bills that go in front of them functionally come from him. That's not the way it's worded, but what that really means is he is deciding what becomes the law. None of this is formal, right? This is not all written down, but this is sort of the changes that's going on in the background. Interestingly, he creates new colonies and starts sending large numbers of the common people, the population of Rome, out to live on farms. He tries to relieve some of the congestion in Rome. We have a census record from 46 BC that suggests the number of people on the dole, the number of people on state welfare, drops by about half. Which maybe suggests that this actually works. And, you know, there's a good policy idea. If you live in New York City, rather than being given a welfare check, you're given a train ticket to Wyoming and told to go work in the oil fields. Probably wouldn't be a popular program today, but it seems to have done something when Caesar was in power. If there is an idea that if you really want to help a poor person, you give them a job. The problem is that the jobs are not in the city. In Roman days or in our days, the jobs that will earn you a living wage are not in the inner city. They're out in the countryside, but then you have to go live out in the countryside. This is looked upon with abject horror by the aristocrats, right? The aristocrats are utterly, utterly terrified by this, which leads to a conspiracy. And since you've done a whole episode, two whole episodes on conspiracies for the Sectarian Review, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, as excuse me, as Danny and I talked about on that conspiracy episode, the assassination of Julius Caesar is actually an example of a real conspiracy. We don't know to this day exactly how many senators were involved in the plot. Plutarch, famously, and a number of other historians name some of the ringleaders, Marcus Junius Brutus being the most prominent, Cassius, Gaius Cassius Longinus, a veteran of
Crassus's campaign into Parthia, by the way. Decimus, a couple of other major ones. Put together a conspiracy to try to remove the threat to the Republic that Caesar poses, thanks to Caesar's massive popularity with the people because of his successful campaigns in Gaul, the goodwill that he has as a hero coming back to have triumphs, et cetera, and having eliminated by this point all of his major rivals. Crassus is long dead. He's been dead for about 10 years. Cicero has been somewhat inactive, sort of crippled by the death of his daughter about this time, but he's back in sort of semi-retirement. Pompey is now dead as a result of his resistance to Caesar being assassinated in Egypt. Caesar is basically all that there is, and so if these senators in this kind of last-ditch effort can steel themselves to actually murder him, they hope to in some way undo a lot of what has been done. Of course, what's already happened to the Republic over the last several generations is partly the real culprit. Caesar is, while a problem, is also part of the symptom of what's wrong with the Republic at this point, the rot that's kind of eaten into it. So they put together a conspiracy, basically planning to, in a final meeting of the Senate in the theater of Pompey, because the Senate House itself was undergoing restoration. So the new location became kind of bitterly ironic, right? A theater endowed by Pompey himself. At the final Senate meeting in the theater of Pompey prior to Caesar's departure to campaign in Parthia for an indeterminate number of years, they decide to waylay and attack him. They actually take extra measures to make sure that this is successful. This thing is not half-baked. One of the wealthier members of the Senate has a hired troop of gladiators on standby at a nearby building just in case the assassination does not come off, or in case there's any kind of resistance. They have actual armed reinforcements to sort of step in and back them up at the last minute if need be. One of the conspirators is tasked with distracting and, if possible, keeping out of the building Mark Antony, who, in addition to being Caesar's most loyal number two at this point, is also a physically strapping man and could easily step up to help Caesar if he sees something going down. And of course, Caesar himself is a threat. He's, you know, in the prime of life. He's a seasoned campaigner and a sturdy soldier, has very good reflexes, as the actual assassination attempt makes clear. But these senators put a good bit of thought into it, trying to orchestrate how they were going to bring this thing down. And they used military weapons to carry it off in the kind of martial spirit of the old Republic. I should probably mention here a book that we could recommend again at the end, The Death of Caesar by the classicist and historian Barry Strauss, who actually brought my attention for the first time to the weapons the senators used, which were army daggers, what's called the pugio, really big, broad-bladed, double-edged dagger, which is common to Roman soldiers at the time. A kind of telling choice of weapon, trying to put a little bit of a martial, courageous gloss on what would otherwise be a pretty cowardly act. So the day of the assassination approaches, Caesar is going to take ship for Parthia the next day. He goes to the meeting of the Senate in the theater of Pompey. Mark Antony is successfully distracted. He's held outside the building by someone who has a personal request for him he wants to talk over. So Caesar enters basically unattended into a meeting of the Senate. They have a few co-conspirators, famously Casca is one of them, who go to Caesar pretending to have requests. One of the conspirators' brothers has been in exile and has not actually been forgiven by Caesar yet. So he's asking for his return home, and like Roman suppliants traditionally do, he kneels before him and kind of grabs a hold of his knees or his legs. And Caesar basically waves him off, says, "No, leave me alone." The guy will not take no for an answer, though. And gradually, it apparently, you know, based on the accounts that we have, apparently dawns on Caesar that something else is going on. This is not just about this request to return a brother from exile. About that moment, the conspirator yanks away Caesar's tunic from around his neck, which is the signal to attack. But they, in this very fraught situation, hesitate, which gives Caesar just enough time. He realizes kind of what's up, or at least it seems that he does, just in time for one of the other conspirators to try to stab him from behind. Caesar catches that out of the corner of his eye, dodges, deflects. Dagger strikes a glancing blow across his collarbone. He stabs the guy very quickly with the stylus that he's carrying, the writing instrument that he's carrying for his wax note tablets. And about this time, finally, the rest of the conspiracy floods the floor of the Senate, the senatorial meeting in the theater. And the numbers are not exactly clear. It seems to be in the neighborhood of 60 men, all charging down at the same time, all armed and all amped up, very, very nervous and pumping the testosterone. They kind of swarm Caesar. They actually stab each other in the process, as nervous as they are. Brutus himself is actually stabbed in the hand before he can even reach Caesar. And famously, Brutus is alleged to be the last person to land a blow. If I remember the number off the top of my head, I think he stabbed 23 times. And a surgeon examining Caesar's body later determined that only one of those wounds actually would have been necessarily fatal. Having then killed essentially Caesar, he staggers back, covers his face to have a death with proper Roman dignitas, right? He doesn't want anybody to see his face go slack or have an undignified death, and actually manages to fall at the feet of the statue of Pompey in the senatorial, in the building where they're having the senatorial meeting. After which the senators rush out into the streets to proclaim what they have done, that they have saved the Republic, and they hope the people will greet them not as murderers, but as saviors.
So a couple of questions to wrap out today, a few questions to wrap out today. First, Julius Caesar, Jordan, hero or tyrant? What do you think?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'd have to say maybe a little bit of both. He is an inspiring figure, and as someone who studies military history, his mastery, maybe not as much of a genius as Alexander, maybe. We can have that throw down later. But his leadership is stunning. He is a very, very good battlefield commander. He knows how to appeal to his soldiers. He knows how to maintain support on the home front. It might also depend on your point of view of, you know, military action and things like that as well, how you interpret that. But he knows what he's doing on the battlefield. This does actually play a role, though, in my assessment of him. Between hero and tyrant, I recognize the heroic aspects, but I tend to swing much more firmly toward tyrant. We've mentioned the Catos, Cato the Elder and Cato the Younger. I tend to sympathize more with them. Caesar does a great deal of damage. A large part of it is in pursuit strictly of personal glory. Political considerations aside, one of the primary motivational factors he has in deciding to cross the Rubicon and kick off a civil war that ends up killing a lot of people is that Caesar cannot be told no, right? Caesar deserves this. Caesar is going to get his triumph. He's going to get his, ultimately his reforms. He's going to get his dictatorship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When he has the opportunity to be Cincinnatus, he decides to be Caesar instead, which points toward, And this is maybe getting a little bit more toward our second question, so I'll wrap up really quickly with this, which points toward the way in which the Roman virtues had deteriorated long before Caesar came along, but certainly by his own lifetime. He was ridiculed and condemned in his own life for failing to live the way a Roman should. He was too interested in women, right? Not only was he too interested in women, he also seemed to be most attracted to married women, which was a gross violation of a number of things that the Romans held dear. He was, if it's possible, too consumed with his own glory, and I think his hero worship of Alexander can kind of point toward that. There's that very, whether it's apocryphal or not, we can't know, but there's that story of him as a young politician in Spain coming across a bust of Alexander and weeping after realizing that he's already older than Alexander was when he's died and he's accomplished nothing. Who you pattern yourself on says a lot about you. And I think, you know, and again, we can have that Alexander discussion later, but patterning himself to some extent on Alexander had some very negative results. But again, pointing toward the fact that Caesar is a great general. He's a great politician. In the terms of the way the city began, he's not a great Roman. Something has severely changed, and those stresses that we talked about, and particularly the degradation of the Roman moral character that Sallust talked about and various other Romans like the Catos talked about. I don't know how they would have remedied that, but it made Caesar possible.
Yeah, and I will come down on the tyrant side too, I think. Basically, everything Caesar does, he does for Caesar.
Right.
Which is not to say he was as bad as he could have been. The tyrant, the word tyrant in the American mind is automatically just as awful as you can be.
Right.
He was a tyrant, but he was a very restrained tyrant. He was not a virtuous tyrant in the old Roman sense of the word virtuous, because that would be an oxymoron, but he was a virtuous tyrant in that he used his power fairly well, and seemed to realize that if he wanted, you know, the glory that he craved, even as a tyrant, he was going to have to try to work for the good of the state. So he sort of voluntarily hitched his own glory to the salvation of the Republic, even if he failed ultimately. That I think, and it may have just been the case that had he not been murdered, we talk about him the way we'll maybe be talking about Augustus Caesar the next time around. But yeah, I think tyrant is certainly right. If you disagree, please feel free to send us an angry email and defend Julius Caesar. How does that matter for today? Where does this stuff count?
Oh boy. I'll try to limit myself to just one or two observations. One, the kind of collapse of shared virtues among a populace. Not to sound like, the cranky aunt you have on Facebook, who decries the collapse of American morals. That's another
kids
discussion.
These days, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Not to be that guy, but a republic, and we could talk about this with the founders at some point. I think we intend to down the road. Republic, as our founders were pretty well aware, thrives at a certain size, a size that's large enough to protect itself, but also small enough for everybody to kind of know each other and have a shared system of virtues, a shared system of kind of guiding principles. Even if you disagree, you're kind of all disagreeing about the same thing without being so large as to encompass all these completely irreconcilable subcultures, to use a modern term. Rome grew beyond that point, and that's where they started running into trouble. The United States, I feel like, almost certainly has grown beyond that point, and probably, and I don't think this is a recent problem by any means. The Mexican War, which was by almost any calculation an unjust war of national aggrandizement, probably a good place to look for some of those kind of, if you'll pardon the pun, some of those Rubicons being crossed.
Sure.
Maybe even before that, who knows? The United States has never been culturally homogenous. Look at David Hackett Fisher with Albion Seed, right? Even among the people coming from England, there were vast differences in what they held dear. So approaching life in a republic soberly, I think, is important with respect to those old traditions. And, clearly I'm one of those kind of cranky Cato kind of conservatives. I guess if I were to make one final point, it would be to watch out for the ambition of the leadership. Rome was in a somewhat different position from us in that their executive leaders were also their military leaders. Directly. I mean, like at the head of the army. There's titular, commander in chief, headship of the military by the president. But beyond making the highest possible level strategic decisions, the president doesn't exercise direct control of the military and so doesn't command that kind of loyalty. Just because he's the current president here, if Barack Obama were to go to an army division somewhere and say, "Follow me, men, we're going to overthrow this thing," that would fall on its face because there's no direct relationship here the way there was between Caesar and his army.
Right.
So in some senses that's a problem that the United States has kind of successfully fixed, I think. But there's still ambition out there. There's still very ambitious people who want power and are willing to go to extreme lengths to get it.
Yeah. And I would actually agree. So this goes against my, I'm also a kind of a cranky old conservative, and this goes a little bit against my grain to say this, but the traditional conservative position is that dictatorship, tyranny, whatever phrase you want to use, arises out of that populism. Mm-hmm. Right. So Caesar was a popularis. He was doing all of that in the name of the Roman people. One of the lessons from this Roman Civil War stuff is that there was also a Sulla. You know, it does not have to come from the common people. There is the idea of a sort of an aristocratic top-down imposition as well. I don't know that that's where our culture is. I don't think you see a lot of, aristocratic cabals working together to overthrow things, to steal another phrase from your sectarian review episode. Or if there are, they're doing a terrible job of it. Yeah, yeah. It's the idea that there are the elite few who run everything. If so, they're just doing a terrible, terrible job.
Right. If it were true, we wouldn't know it.
Yeah. So this stuff is relevant because I think it's relevant because we see the effect of factionalism on a society that I think is just caused by human sin. I don't think there's actually anything that can be undone by it.
Right.
But it's worth at least paying attention to see how another republic has engaged these problems and ultimately failed to overcome them.
Absolutely.
Or at least, depending on what we think of Augustus, which is for next time, failed to overcome them. So if people want to learn more about this, what can they read?
I'd point, I don't know what you've got on tap here, but
I'm sure we'll have a giant list of these. So
I mentioned Sallust by name. You can read, I believe, all of his surviving work. He's a great historian who we've lost most of what he wrote. I believe you can read all of his extant work in a Penguin Classic, which I have, and I actually just reread last summer. Again, like the many other ancient historians, he was obliged to be interesting, so he's actually literarily worth reading.
He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, as well as being not a contemporary of everything he wrote about, but a near contemporary, coming along in like the next generation or two after, for instance, Marius and Sulla and things like that. I definitely recommend him.
He's a Caesar appointee to office.
Yeah, he is. I can't remember his exact relationship, but he is an affiliate of Caesar. He was on Caesar's coattail somewhere.
Right.
Or apron strings or whatever metaphor you prefer.
Toga tails.
Yeah, there you go. So that's a good ancient historian I would point to. Caesar himself is worth reading. He knows how to tell an entertaining story, and amazingly for a man with such an ego, historians have not really been able to pick a lot of his stuff apart. He seems to have mostly told the truth about himself, which is pretty remarkable. Again, also worth reading. I'm not trying to be a shill for Penguin here, but I have those in the Penguin Classics as well. They're easy to pick up. You can find them in almost any Barnes & Noble.
And they're cheap, which is the big selling point.
Yeah, that's why I have so many of them. I was a poor college student at some point. Now I'm a poor college instructor. Finally, for some contemporary people, I mentioned I just forgot his name. I left my copy in there. The Roman Realities by Finley Hooper. I've been revisiting that as we've been preparing for these discussions, and it's definitely held up. It was my college textbook when I was introduced to the Romans, and it's a really great read. I'd recommend that. Something a little bit more contemporary, Adrian Goldsworthy got the thumbs up here. British military historian, man after my own heart, who wrote probably the best available one-volume biography of Caesar out there. It's called Caesar, Life of a Colossus. Goldsworthy's a really outstanding historian, and he's also good to read, so I would recommend him. Looking forward, he's also got biographies of Augustus out there. That's his latest one, which I've also read. Another one of Antony and Cleopatra. Basically, any book by him I would recommend.
Bunch of stuff on the Punic Wars too, right?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. His book on the Punic Wars is also very good. It's published under different titles in different places. I think in the United States it's The Fall of Carthage.
Yeah, something like that.
But if you search for Adrian Goldsworthy either on Amazon or at the bookstore, you should be able to find something by him.
All right, and I would suggest, if you want sort of a good overview of the time period we've been talking about today, I forget the name of the author, a book called From the Gracchi to Nero. The tradition.
Scullard.
Yeah. And then that's sort of the traditional, like, sophomore, college sophomore level introduction to the time.
Right.
Yeah, a more A more in-depth approach to the Roman Revolution is a book called The Roman Revolution by an author named Syme. And we'll put links to these up on the webpage. If you want sort of the military side, but that also touches on the political, Goldsworthy is fantastic. I really do like Goldsworthy. I also appreciate an older writer named Theodore Dodge.
Yes.
So he has a biography of Alexander, who we didn't talk about, Hannibal and Caesar. And then I think he goes on and does like Gustavus Adolphus and Napoleon. But he was a Civil War general who decided he wanted to study how war had changed over time through the filter of these great men. So his biographies of Hannibal and Caesar are both excellent. The Hannibal biography sounds a little bit like Hannibal is Robert E. Lee, but it's still worth picking up and reading.
Yeah.
And then one that I don't like as much, but is a classic in the field, by an author named Christian Meyer, another biography of Caesar. It's the one I had to read for my senior level undergrad, whatever. He's a German writer, so it's not necessarily the most thrilling reading, but it gets kind of all of the facts into one place.
Right.
Not necessarily Germans. Lots of flavor, but lots of facts. Yeah. And then Plutarch for primary sources, always right. A good sort of go-to short read with lots of fun, but not always as in-depth as maybe we'd like.
Can I drop in one more?
Yeah, sure.
I thought of this as you were mentioning it. Scullard covers a lot of the same ground as a more popular level writer named Tom Holland.
He
wrote a book called Rubicon. He's just followed it up with a book called Dynasty, which begins with Augustus and runs through the end of the Julio-Claudians. I haven't read all of Rubicon, but what I have is really, really good. And he is also Tom Holland is also on Twitter, and he is he's great to follow on Twitter because he has a lot of like funny stuff. He's like on a British authors cricket team or something, which is I don't understand the first thing about cricket. But he also shares a whole lot of stuff about Roman and Islamic and medieval history.
Okay, I have the book. I have not read it yet.
It's kind of like a more thrilling, popular level version of Scullard.
Okay, which thank goodness there needs to be something like that. Scullard is good, but man, it's kind of a slog. And
Holland is a very skilled writer, which is a plus.
Well, he did a novel too, right? Didn't he?
Yeah, he and his brother. He has a brother who's. It's funny. I run into both of them because of my interests. He has a brother who does World War II history. And they have also both written fiction.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of like man of letters that I would love to be.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like Adrian Goldsworthy. I mean, at some point he retired from teaching and now is just an advisor to the History Channel and writes books.
Has also written some fiction about Napoleon, curiously.
Really? I don't know that I knew that. I know he's sort of the gold standard of historians. Like every historian wants to be him, and many of them, since they can't, they hate him. But you know, since you mentioned fiction, I will sort of publicly shame myself a little bit here. There's a series of books by an author named Colleen McCullough.
Yeah.
Which if people like romance novels, which I do not, but she is originally a romance author. I think she wrote one called The Thorn Birds that was popular, which I have not read.
Series.
Yeah, I have not read and I have not seen because it's kind of trashy romance. But at some point she decided she loved Roman history and wrote a series of novels about the Roman Revolution, starting with Sulla and working through Augustus. I believe the first in that series is called First Man in Rome that was about Sulla. It is a bit lascivious at points. There is that romance writer that breaks through, but from what I remember, her details are exactly right. Like she fills in the historical narrative really well while still being a good writer.
Nice.
So I actually had her book assigned in a senior level undergrad class, one of the books in that series. And, you know, when we compared it to the biographies we were reading, where, you know, she tells the story in a much more interesting way, albeit with more lewd content maybe than the biographies have. But again, the details are right if you can handle some of the writing.
Right.
Well, with that, the City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out other podcasts in our family and get more information about our own show and or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Kindly leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, or like us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can also get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song and Jordan Poss, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.